Hello, and welcome back to the Coolidge Connection. My name is Joanna McCool, and the purpose of this series is to explore the legacy Calvin Coolidge left by interviewing people connected to him and his family. It is important to remember that children are a part of their parents' legacy. And this week, my interviewee, Mr. John Dumville, speaks about the kind of man Calvin Coolidge's son, John, was. Mr. Dumville worked for the State of Vermont Historical Sites since 1979 and knew John Coolidge from then until Coolidge's passing in 2000. Today, Mr. Dumville shares what it was like to meet and know the son of a president, a man of remarkable character, which was shaped by the way he was raised. Enjoy hearing stories behind the historic site at Plymouth Notch, items in the Forbes Library, and the conception behind the Presidential Foundation, and learn more about what it was like to be President Coolidge's son at college. Thank you for tuning in. All right, so I guess the first question is, how did you end up in Plymouth Notch?
I was hired by the State of Vermont as the Historic Sites Operations Chief, which meant I managed and directed the statewide system of state-owned historic sites. And the Coolidge site is one of 12 properties that I managed. My office was in Montpelier, the state capital, and I'd go down to Plymouth on occasion to oversee what was going on. And I was hired in 1979.
And so when did you first meet John Coolidge?
I met him that spring when he came up. I was hired in November, and the Coolidges go down to Connecticut in the winter to a house they owned in Hartford. And our caretaker, Liza Hoskinson, called me to let me know that the Coolidges were coming up in, I don't know whether it was May or June, just to let me know they were going to be there.
And can you describe your first meeting with John Coolidge?
It was scary. I would say, oh my God, I'm going to meet a president's son. I've never met anyone like that. But I knew he wanted to meet me, so I walked down to his house, knocked on the door, and introduced myself and said, I'm John Dumville, I'm the new person. And I said, hello, Mr. Coolidge. And he said, oh, I'm in Plymouth. I'm known as John, and my wife, Florence. He was very informal and very welcoming. He had no pretenses, no airs about him, but you knew who he was. And he didn't want to be treated special. He wanted to be treated just like any other person in Plymouth.
How would you describe him?
I would describe him as a very kind and generous man who was very welcoming. And generally a good person. Very quiet and reserved, but also once he got to know you, he was very open. Florence was entirely different. Florence was a bubbly, vivacious woman and loved meeting with people.
How would you describe your friendship with John?
I wouldn't say we're great personal friends. We're professional friends. He would call here at my home, usually in the always in the evening, because he was never a morning person. And he knew he could reach me at night and just say, oh, Florence has found something, stop in. Or if you're in Plymouth this week, just come by and we can chat. He was very open. When I was in the village, I'd usually go down once a week, but I wouldn't go to his house every week. And just walk over and say, hello, do you have anything you want to talk about? And we'd meet. John walked freely through the village. He'd go up to the cheese factory almost every day when he was operating it to just see how things were going. He'd take the big wheels of cheese over to Rutland to be smoked. He'd walk through the village. Most people had no idea he was the president's son, and he liked it that way. He didn't want to be called out. Our staff would never say, ooh, there's John Coolidge, the president's son. He was just there, and he wanted to know everyone who worked in the village. He liked talking to the groundskeepers. He liked talking to the hosts in each of the building, just chatting. How's your day? What's going on? Are your grandchildren up visiting? He was very connected into the community. And after his wife died, he decided to move to Vermont full time because he was one of the regular people in Plymouth and didn't have to be held up as someone special. Plymouth was where he always thought home belonged.
So home for him was always Vermont, even though...
Well, he grew up in Northampton. But after the presidency, after his adulthood, and he married Florence, he lived in Connecticut. But he always came to Vermont in the summer, visiting. And once he retired, he spent all summer here. And then he'd sort of laugh when fall came, oh, I got to head south, meaning down to Hartford, Connecticut, where his wife was from. His wife, Florence, was the daughter of the Connecticut governor. So Hartford was home for her. Plymouth was home for him. And they would split their time between the two places.
Did you know Florence Coolidge?
Oh, yeah. No, she was always around when he was there. And she'd let him speak for things, but she was always the one prompting him on what to give to the state. Because she'd go through the house and would find something and said, oh, this is a presidential thing. It really should go to the state. We need to do something with it. But there were a few items in the house that she thought should be returned to Washington. There was a large rug from Armenia that had some political issues that she felt really needed to go back to Washington. So that got sent down to National Archives. There was a desk that was given to Grace Coolidge by the women in the Senate that she thought belonged in Secretary of State's offices of the State Department. She wanted it on display there, which is good because we would have had no place to display it. But she kind of kept track of where things were and directed how to manage different collections.
And how would you describe Florence?
Fun-loving. She enjoyed it. She loved flowers. She loved to talk. She was the social half of the family.
Compared to John Coolidge, who was
a lot more quiet. He was much more quiet and reserved. She was the more outgoing person. But he was the one who would always initiate the calls to me to come over. But she was always the one who would answer the door and welcome you in and just be the gracious hostess and then would step away.
Do you know how she and John met?
They met on the train. He was a student at Amherst, Massachusetts, and she was a college student at Mount Holyoke, and he was heading home to Northampton, or maybe to Washington, I don't know which. And when Florence heard that John was on the train, she thought she should go and welcome him as the governor's daughter. And they were introduced that way. And it clicked. It worked. They were very devoted to each other. It was wonderful. We did a presidential site tour to various presidential sites in Vermont, New Hampshire, New York. And one of them was Paul Smith's White Pine Camp, where Coolidge had his summer White House. And very interesting property. And I asked John about it. So we had a number of pictures, and we knew John had been there. And John said, yeah, I went for a couple of days, but I didn't like it. I wanted to get home. I wanted to see Florence again. He would rather spend time with the new lady that he met than spend time with his father in a very public place at Paul Smith's. Besides, there were mosquitoes.
Do you have just any funny stories or very special memories of them that you would like to share?
Let's see. I remember one time visiting with the Coolidges, just sitting down in the front sitting room, and we were just chatting away. And suddenly John reached over to the table next to him and grabbed something, looked at me and had a little smile on his face. And he said, smile, catch, as he tossed a baseball signed by Babe Ruth over to me and said, here, this belonged to my father. I'd like you to have it, meaning the historic site. Amazingly enough, I caught it. I'm a lousy catch with baseballs, but he wanted the state to have it. And then he started just laughing. He would talk about his mother and his mother's love for baseball. His father wasn't a great fan. He appreciated it, but it was Grace who really kept track of the baseball teams and the scores and loved going. But it was another thing that belonged to his father that he thought should be held by the state and used as an exhibit item. And we bring it out and do different exhibits, and it's one of the more popular things to show. Sports items really make a click with the visiting public. Grace's gowns they wanted us to have, the formal wear that she had. It was very nice for them to donate those. Upstairs in the Coolidge homestead, things were still in boxes. They'd never really been opened. And our site manager and I were going through boxes one day, and one day there was a suit. We looked at, it's interesting, just a dark suit, carefully wrapped up, and reached in one of the pockets, and we pulled out. It was the program for the inauguration. And we said something to John. He said, oh, yeah, that was the suit my father wore when he was inaugurated in 1924.
Wow.
Which is casually boxed up in the home. And in the homestead, every once in a while, you'd find a tag that Grace Coolidge had put on something that had belonged to the family. One year, he called me over and he said, I'd like to give to the state the kerosene lamp and the Bible that was in the parlor when Calvin was sworn in as president. He said, I got called by the Smithsonian. They wanted it, but they don't need it. It really needs to stay here in Vermont. So it was nice to have those put back into the homestead, and they're on exhibit now. He was very open and generous in donating anything that he thought should belong to the public. You think of him as a very conservative man, but he was also a very giving and understanding man. Now, he very much wanted Plymouth to be a premier historic site, really helping to interpret his father and to interpret the era that Calvin Coolidge grew up in. And very, very conscious of the village and the way it looked and the way things were cared for and maintained. I mean, he walked through the village every day when he was there, smiling, and he just enjoyed the village. He would tend to his parents' gravesite. We got a letter from some visitor who complained about the state having this old man trimming around the cemetery. Well, that old man was Calvin Coolidge's son. He wanted to do it himself. He didn't want others doing it. He was very much involved in his own very quiet way.
Wow, he sounds like a special son to his parents.
Yeah, yeah. He's very devoted to his father's legacy, very loving with his mother, and with his two daughters, Lydia and Cynthia, were just amazing. The way they would always come up and just want to meet you and see what was going on. They were two grand, wonderful ladies.
Did John ever talk about his family or his time in the White House?
You would ask him questions, and he was very open at answering them. But he also wanted you to know that he never really lived in the White House. He was a high school student at Mercersburg and would come and visit his father. And then when he was a student at Amherst, he lived at the college. When he went to the stayed in the White House, you know, on vacations and stuff, it was a very formal affair that he was expected to behave and dress properly and be respectful. I don't think he had much interaction with the public. They tried to keep his private life very private. He didn't get involved with politics at all. I don't think politics were really a topic the family discussed around the dinner table.
That's very interesting, considering who his father was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I don't think Grace really got involved with politics. She might have quietly said things, but she wasn't what we'd consider the Hillary Clinton or any of the first ladies today. She was very quiet herself.
So did John ever tell you any stories about his parents or memories of them, especially like the stories of his youth?
Nothing that really stands out. I know he was a musical kid, and of course he would make references to his brother who died when they were playing tennis. But he was very respectful of the family and the family traditions. Just the family privacy and quiet ways of doing things. He didn't really go into intimate details. And I never pushed him on any of those things because I think he considered those private internal family affairs.
Do you think those were the wishes of his parents?
I think it was just the way you were brought up. He just quietly went about his business. I know his father was very strict, particularly when he was at Amherst, telling him not to bring up his father's name, not to give out his father's signature, to always be sure his clothes were in order, not to spend money wildly. Didn't have it. Of course, he had a Secret Service agent staying in his room with him. He never really talked much about the Secret Service agent and how it limited what he wanted to do, because he seemed to enjoy life and just tried to live as normally as a kid could by trying to stay out of the spotlight.
That is really interesting about the Secret Service agent.
Yeah.
How would you describe John's relationship with his parents?
I think it was very reserved with his father. His father was very strict, but his mother was much more open and giving and loving, showing her affection for John, and particularly when John married Florence and with their two granddaughters. She doted on them. They were very close.
You did say that John would mention his younger brother, Calvin Jr., in passing. Did he ever have any stories or talk about his brother in detail?
Not in great detail. There was one time when Florence was the one who initiated giving things to the state. She'd find things in the attic or in the house and would call up and say, come over, we have some things for you, meaning the historic site, not me personally. And one day she had a pile of stuff that belonged to or represented Calvin Jr. Some medals, coins, a ring, a book that Grace had read when Calvin Jr. was dying. And she handed them over and said, we'd like to give these to you. And John would look at them, and then he looked at him and said, I'm not really ready to give these up. So he wanted to keep them. They still meant a lot to him. They were personal things that he really treasured. But anything that had been given to his father by heads of state, he felt didn't really belong to him. They belonged to the public and would generously donate them over the years to the state as he saw how we were caring and interpreting the historic site. He was very supportive of the state owning and managing the property. He felt very comfortable with the public ownership.
Can you talk more on that point and about how invested John was in preserving his father's legacy?
Well, he followed his mother's wishes and donated the Coolidge homestead to the state of Vermont. He donated with all of its furnishings and personal pieces, with the exception of some things that were upstairs, because the public was not going to go upstairs, but the house was virtually turned over intact. There had been an addition built onto the building by Calvin shortly before his death, and part of the deal in donating the homestead to the state was that the state would detach that addition and move it across the fields, and John and Florence would live in it as their summer home, and that was done. And when any property came up in the village for sale, John would step forward and purchase it and hold on to it until the state was able to get the money from the Vermont taxpayers or through federal grants to buy it from him. John would buy it, hold on to it, and sell it to the state for what he paid. He never tried to make money on holding property. He was just very generous and really wanted to preserve the historic site and its integrity. He said, it's not one building, it's the entire village that was my father's upbringing. And he thought the entire area needed to be protected and preserved to show how a young boy in Vermont grew up and eventually became president. He was incredibly generous and open and really wanted to preserve his father's and mother's memory.
Can you speak to the difference between preserving the Notch and Village and also the Forbes Library?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, Calvin Coolidge set up the Forbes Library collection. Even when he was mayor and governor, he would turn his official papers over to the city library to establish a Calvin Coolidge room. He had his presidential papers deposited there. When he left the White House, boxes and boxes of papers came to the Forbes Library. Some furnishings and some important paintings and collection items went to the Forbes because it was something his father established and Grace supported. Over the years, once the state of Vermont started buying property in Plymouth, John wanted the Plymouth site to house the three-dimensional objects that he had not yet turned over. Toward the end of his life, when he was trying to clear up everything, I sat down with him and we looked at what he had, and we made the decision that any papers that were presidential belonged to the Forbes Library. Archival materials that were presidential or political went to Forbes. All of the family papers, the diaries, journals, and photographs, he wanted the state of Vermont to have. And we didn't feel we should keep them at Plymouth because we had no library. We had no librarian staff. Instead, we directed that those things go to the Vermont Historical Society in Montpelier, now Barrie, because they have an archival facility. They have trained librarians and archivists. So those papers would be much more accessible to the public who are doing research. And it worked very well because Vermont is a small state. And we know all the people at the Vermont Historical Society. They know everyone involved with historic sites. And we work very closely together. Anything we need to borrow, we borrow things back and forth. We just figure it's all owned by the public, but it's owned in the responsible spot where it can properly be curated and cared for. It works well for us because we have the objects, the three-dimensional things, which we put on display in rotating exhibits. If we need a letter or a photograph, we borrow it from the Vermont Historical Society. And if they need a Coolidge object, we loan it out there. But we're always loaning presidential gifts of state to other presidential libraries, too. They know where to come to us or to Forbes or Vermont Historical Society. We're all interconnected. It seems to work well. John never thought, and Florence never thought, of the Coolidge Foundation itself as a collecting organization. They would be an organization that would sort of link people and be a resource, but they wouldn't operate a museum. They would be more of a center to promote the Coolidge idea. We, the state, would never interpret a political aspect of the Coolidge presidency. We needed to be very even-keeled on how we interpreted things. So we would, the surface mention the political things, but we wouldn't go into any detail on the Coolidge political philosophy. That would be something the Coolidge Foundation could do as a private nonprofit group.
Can you talk about the Plymouth Cheese Factory? Because I hear it has some of the best cheese, and I know that it is very connected as well with the Coolidge family.
Well, the Cheese Factory was started by Colonel John Coolidge, Calvin's father, and other farmers in the area as a way to process raw milk. They didn't have the refrigeration. They couldn't ship milk, but they could ship butter and cheese. And it operated successfully until around, the Great Depression and closed. Dairy farming was going out of business. Refrigeration came and they were able to ship fluid milk. And it sat inactive until the mid-1960s, and John Coolidge ended up owning all the extra shares and thought, well, he wanted to preserve the building because it was beginning to look pretty ratty. And he thought, well, I can reestablish the cheese factory and it will provide jobs in the area. So he reformatted the cheese factory to make cheese using the traditional recipe, meeting current health standards, and successfully reestablished the cheese factory. His goal all along was that eventually the state would buy the property from him and would control the building and the formula, but would lease the operation out to a private business. And the state eventually did purchase the property from John, and we now have a very good cheesemaker, Leo and Jesse Warner, who are making the Coolidge cheese the traditional way and other varieties. And it's a good going business and providing a number of little jobs in the small village of Plymouth and is marketing the cheese across the country. It's a good cheese. And Jesse is doing a great job there.
And that's fantastic that it has that history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can buy the cheese in my little co-op here in little town South Royalton. It's a popular cheese here. You can find it all over. When I go to Maine, I see it in stores in Maine. It's good. I mean, it's an artisanal cheese. It's a small manufacturing, so you aren't going to buy it to make your regular macaroni and cheese. It's a nibbly cheese.
And that's really cool that it's not just in Plymouth Notch, that you can find in other areas as well.
We have a restaurant here in town, we're 30 miles from Plymouth, that hamburgers, and they use the Plymouth cheese on their cheeseburgers. It's good.
You said that John was very invested in how the village was preserved. Do you think he would be happy with where it's at right now?
I would hope so, and I don't think there's anything going on in the village that he'd be upset with. I think he'd be, this COVID stuff, closing everything down would be a big concern, but it's a concern with everybody. He would be very proud of the way the village has been maintained and preserved. We miss John and Florence because they're very much a part of our work at the historic site. But they never wanted to control anything. They liked to know what was going on. They never gave any direct orders. This can be done. This shouldn't be done. With the exception of an oil portrait of John. He did request when he donated it that we not put it on display until after he had died. Because he didn't want the site to focus on him. And we really respected that. We do have a photograph of him in the exhibit in the visitor center, because we really felt we need to honor John and Florence for all their contributions. And it's a wonderful picture of John and Florence with beaming smiles as they're looking down at something. They did smile. They did enjoy life.
Are there any just last remarks or anything that you want to leave people off with?
We'd encourage people to come to Plymouth to learn about the real Calvin Coolidge, see where he lived, how simple it was, and what a kind and wonderful man and the family.
All right. That is all the questions I have for you at the moment.
Okay. I'm here if you need more.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed talking to you and learning more. Enjoy the rest of your day.
I will. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for joining us here at the Coolidge Connection. This series is brought to you by the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, which is dedicated to preserving the memory and legacy of America's 30th president through various resources such as our Debate League, Scholarship Award, and our new virtual library. To learn more about the Coolidge Foundation and get involved, please visit us online at coolidgefoundation.org. We hope you will join us in our mission to spread timeless Coolidge values across the country. A very special thank you goes out to Mr. John Dumville, who shared his time and stories with us. I look forward to sharing another Coolidge Connection with you again soon.